This is an ABC podcast.
See, my day, it was only between ourselves. The pushers, they used to call us. See, I never killed anyone as a clean living person. I still believe there's a God, but I don't agree with the way he acts. Decent living people has never done anything to anyone in their life, and their child's born to imbecile or blind or deformed. Yet he lets an old bastard like me at 80 live.
That's the voice of Chow Hayes, one of the most ruthless killers in Australia's gangland history. Chow Hayes is being interviewed there by Margaret Throsby back in 1990. He was 80 years old at the time. In the interview, he claimed he had no regrets at all, and that the hard circumstances of Australian life in the slums of Sydney left him no choice but to enter a life of crime. Chow Hayes' criminal career began with the Sydney crime wars of the 1920s. It was the era of the razor gangs. But Chow didn't use a razor. He used guns. He shot and killed maybe five people, maybe more, maybe less, it's not clear. One of those killings was conducted in the middle of a crowded nightclub, in front of 80 people, none of whom reckoned they saw a thing. Jack Hoisted returns to Conversations today. Jack is a true crime writer. He was a producer on Tough Nuts, and he's also a columnist for The Australian, where he blogs under the name of Jack the Insider. Jack has long been fascinated with the story of Chow Hayes, and he says his story holds up a mirror to Australian society in the 20th century. Welcome back, Jack.
G'day, Richard.
You've got a portrait of Chow Hayes in your study, painted by Bill Leake. Does he actually loom over your shoulder, literally, Jack?
He does. That black-eyed stare comes back at me often, and it's a very unforgiving sort of look. Most beautifully painted by Bill Leake. Bill made two prints of it, and he gave one to me very generously. And when people come into my office, they don't look at that portrait and go, oh, what a lovely looking old man. Is he your grandfather? I mean, no one ever makes that mistake. They see this man, and there's a sense of menace and ferocity in that portrait that's beautifully captured by Bill.
Are there any visible scars on him in the portrait?
Yes, there is. There is a bite-sized chunk from his right ear that was got in a prison fight. And later in life, of course, Chow, as an extortionist, would just continue to harangue and harass people that are often younger, fitter, stronger than he was. So when he was in jail in the latter part of his life, he really came up against some very willing villains who certainly weren't going to take a backward step around him.
Why do you think his story is so particularly fascinating? What is it about Chow's story that sort of has these larger ramifications, Jack?
Well, his life entwines around Australian social history, and Sydney's social history in particular. He grew up between the wars. He was still active after the war. And then after this long term of imprisonment, he comes out into a new world, and he really can't adapt to it. So his history is almost Sydney's history.
He grew up in the slums of Sydney, inner city, in the aftermath of the First World War, after all those men came back from France and from Gallipoli and from elsewhere. Just paint a bit of a picture of what the conditions were like in the slums of inner city Sydney in those days, Jack.
Well, it's really terrible existence. I mean, Australia was less than two decades old. It had gone through World War One, suffered enormous casualties, and so at the end of the war, virtually a generation of men are gone. If they've returned, they're in a very bad way. They're often physically injured, carrying terrible scars, or carrying psychological scars as well. So we basically have lost a decade of men. It's come at great financial cost to the country as well. And Australia was really battling along. You know, if you lived in Sydney and you walked around Central Station, you would be constantly reminded of just how much Australia had suffered. There'd be men shaking tins with limbs missing. There'd be men with horrible scars begging on the streets. The Australian government really wasn't in a position to, or just didn't seem to understand or care about what had happened to its World War One veterans. So many of them were just demobbed in 1918, sent home, often with their firearms. And so they'd either become a sort of brooding presence in the household with a firearm stashed not far away, or indeed many of them became criminals and took their AIF issue firearms with them to commit a bit of mischief around the place.
What kind of diseases were actually festering in these inner-city suburbs, Jack?
Well, the slums were just awful places. I mean, Frog Hollow is the famous one.
Where is Frog Hollow?
Frog Hollow, which is in Albion Street, not far from Central Station. There's a park named after it today. But these were slums that were routinely torn down and rebuilt, and they just languished again into poverty and disease. Immediately post-war, there was a Spanish influenza outbreak. So any photographs that you see of people in that time, they're all sort of covering themselves with handkerchiefs. But there's also, and this is really odd, and Chow Hay's grandfather died of it, there was bubonic plague in Australia.
The bubonic plague in inner city Sydney?
There were five visitations of the Black Death.
That's medieval, Jack.
I know. I mean, in 1900, I think 3,000 Australians died of bubonic plague, largely around Woolloomooloo and the docks there. Sometimes it spread into neighbouring Darlinghurst and into Surry Hills. Chow Hayes was born in Paddington. Because in those days, Paddington was a fairly desperate sort of place. And as you got closer to the city, Surry Hills, Darlinghurst, Woolloomooloo, they were much, much worse. These were places, sort of breeding grounds of poverty, crime and disease.
So his grandfather was carried off by the bubonic plague. What about his mum and dad? Were they present for his upbringing?
Well, his father joined the Light Horse in 1914, and he received terrible psychological injuries in World War One, and at the conclusion of the war, he remained in the UK receiving treatment for what was then called shell shock, and was transported back to Australia in about 1922. And the only time Chow ever saw his father from that point was basically seeing him at Callan Park Institute for the Insane. Chow looked in to where his father was being kept and saw his father in a straitjacket in a padded cell.
How long did Chow Hayes stay at school?
I left school at 8. I mean, he wasn't one for formal education. I mean, this is it. His grandfather's gone. His father's gone. There is no significant male role model for Chow Hayes. He was raised by his mother and his grandmother, but he just became wild.
How did he get his nickname? Because his real name was John Frederick Hayes.
John Frederick.
Yeah, how did he get the nickname Chow?
I believe it goes back to his very brief time at school. He left at 8. He probably started at 6, so he wouldn't only been there a couple of years. And he had this sort of vaguely Asiatic look to his face. So other pupils called him Chow, and it stuck, really, from the time he was 7 or 8. He became Chow Hayes. He was selling newspapers at Central Station, and that's what he did from the time of 8. And from that time, really, by the time he was 9 or 10, he was shoplifting, stealing from stores, moving goods around, fencing them to Kate Lee, who's a very interesting character in Sydney crime scene.
What was the crime scene like in Australia in this period, in the early 1920s?
Look, we're often sort of knocked around the head these days, and there's a crime spree on in Queensland, or there's one in Victoria, or there's one in New South Wales, or elsewhere around the country. There was no greater crime rate in Australia than in the 1920s. The murder rate, the rates of violent offending, almost twice what they are today.
And do you connect that to these returned servicemen coming home unbalanced, unhappy, traumatised and with a nearby firearm?
To a degree, but Australia was in very, very desperate circumstances. It wasn't just that men had returned and that they were scarred from war. Well, it's very difficult to understand. I mean, this was like sending a wrecking ball through Australian society, World War One. And afterwards, it was a really sort of desperate sort of place, particularly around inner city Sydney and inner city Melbourne.
So how did the New South Wales government then react to this spike in gun violence?
Well, soldiers were often demobbed with their sidearms or with their rifles, which is just bizarre when you think about it. I mean, it's just a disaster waiting to happen. And so the New South Wales government, this sort of resonates today, they decided they were going to bring in a mandatory 1 year in jail if you're found with an unlicensed firearm. It does resonate today, you know, in terms of we've got a problem, media is screaming in the background, so a government feels compelled to do something, and it does something that doesn't necessarily give the sort of good outcomes that they want.
Yeah. So what happened with it once they made it mandatory for you to be sent into the jug for a year if you were found in possession of an unlicensed firearm?
Well, most people didn't want to go to jail. Most men didn't want to go to jail. So they actually either secreted their weapons or handed them in and wouldn't walk around the streets with them. So they, in turn, chose something that was easier to hide, wasn't going to cost them a year in jail, and that was a straight razor. I mean, you could just stick it in your sock and no one would say boo about it. So the rifles and the guns went down, for the most part, to be replaced by the straight razor, which in many ways is a sort of almost as lethal and certainly as horrible a weapon.
So this gives rise to the famous razor gangs of the 1920s. Have you seen some of the mugshots from around about this time when, you know, I think they've got them at the police museum in Sydney, Jack, those amazing mugshots with crooks with these terrible scars across their faces?
Yeah, virtually every third mugshot you look at has got some form of facial scarring. So men would be sort of slicing one another up with straight razors, men and women too. I mean, the violence was directed at women as well. And so this is what happened. This was a sort of unintended consequence of this ban on firearms in Australia. The people like Chow Hayes, they were always going to keep their guns. Chow had no problem with doing a year in jail, but others were deterred, and so they picked up straight razors. And there were almighty fights in the streets of Darlinghurst and Woolloomooloo where sort of 20 or 30 men from different gangs would just converge on each other and slice each other up.
Like Viking warriors in the middle of downtown Sydney.
It's just terrible, yeah. Terrible wounds that people suffered.
So Chow hung onto his guns throughout this entire period. Where did he stash them?
He used to hide them all around Glebe. He'd have one there, he'd have one at Surrey Hills, he'd have one in Darlinghurst and so forth. So whenever he needed to, he could just simply go to these places and pick up a gun.
The other thing that changed at this time, Jack, was that the drug laws got changed. What effect did that have?
Oh, massive effect. Cocaine was criminalised in 1925 in New South Wales in a similar time, similar year in Victoria. And prior to that, if you wanted to get some cocaine, you didn't have to go all the way to South America. You could just walk to the pharmacy and get some.
Wasn't it sold as a kind of like a pick-me-up sort of health tonic?
Yeah, at times? It was. I mean, it was an elixir. You'd find it in cough syrups. You'd find it in various things that would be likely to sort of brighten you up a bit.
Cocaine and rowing, the way to good health and good fortune for young men.
Yes, just it'll make sure you don't stop. And so there was a large amount of cocaine that was being stored around Sydney in chemical warehouses. These places were being robbed. A bunch of criminals started stealing the cocaine and distributing it around the streets, often through prostitutes and often through the sly grog houses. It's important to remember that from the decade preceding, that Australia had these incredibly stupid liquor licensing laws, a 6 o'clock closing. And so in areas like Surrey Hills, Darlinghurst, Woolloomooloo, and elsewhere for that matter too, these sly grog shops would pop up where men and women could go for a drink after 6 o'clock.
Yes, because honest men and women can develop a powerful thirst after 6 p.m, Jack.
Well, it turned men into monsters, just the business of a 6 o'clock closing. You know, so your drinkers there would throw back 8 schooners in the space of about 15 minutes before the pub's shut.
Then jump into a car and drive home.
Indeed, you know, or go home and be full of vinegar and horror. But men in the know could go around to these sly grog shops. They were just houses where people could go and pay for a drink, and they could also buy cocaine there. And these places were run by a raft of criminals, and Kate Lee was the most prominent. She had at least half a dozen sly grog shops around the inner Sydney area. It was sort of a criminal hub. It gave them the opportunity to move stolen goods, because at this stage Chow's providing Kate Lee with a lot of stolen goods from department stores, and Kate Lee could move those goods around, move cocaine around, and of course sell alcohol.
Now, this is a period when the kingpins of Sydney crime were two women, Kate Lee and Tilly Devine. Chow Hayes worked for Kate Lee. Did he work for Tilly Devine as well, Jack?
No, he disliked Tilly Devine intensely. Kate was the local girl. She was born and bred Australian. Tilly Devine had come to Australia from post-war, again, with her Australian serviceman husband, Frank, who was a piece of work as well, very violent human being. And Tilly had been a prostitute in the streets of London at the age of 12. So she'd seen some fairly horrific things, experienced some fairly horrific things by the time she got to Australia. But the two of them, Lee and Devine, were kind of rather vicious women. Tilly set up brothels around Sydney, and she would pay her working girls in cocaine. So she became a great mover of cocaine. They didn't get paid for their jobs. They were given cocaine, and they would have to sell the cocaine to their johns and to other individuals, and that's how the prostitutes or the working girls in Australia or in Sydney were making their money.
God, they would have become virtual slaves under those conditions.
That's just exactly what happened. I mean, these girls became addicted to cocaine in order to buy more cocaine. They had to continue in prostitution. It was a really wicked business that Tilly Devine was running.
So what was Chow's line of work in those days early on in his career, Jack?
Look, he is learning some important lessons about how he's going to succeed at this time. Yes, he starts off as a very young, you can understand this, at 10, 11, he's shoplifting in a sort of organised way. But as he's getting older, he's starting to see how the underbelly of Sydney works and how he can impose himself on it. He's not a big man. He's about 5'8" in the old. He's not broad-shouldered. He's sort of wiry sort of build.
Well, how would he actually intimidate people?
Well, it's all done by reputation. In the business of extortion, if someone uses a knife, then Chow would respond with a gun. If someone committed an assault, then he would commit a worse one. Always having to one-up whatever foe he was up against at the time.
So how did Chow actually establish this reputation for fearsome violence?
Well, one incident really tells you a great deal about Chow Hayes himself and his propensity for violence, and doing so in the knowledge that it will enhance his reputation. He attends a party in Paddington, and he is seen there talking to one of the ladies. Frank Green arrives, and Frank Green is a sly grogger. He's a person with a reputation for violence. He's a much older man than Chow. He walks into this party and sees Chow inveigling himself on this young woman and comes up and humiliates Chow, orders him from the party. So Chow leaves, but he waits outside, and he waits for 6 hours. He waits for 6 hours for Frank Green to come out. And when Frank Green comes out, there's Chow Hayes with a metal bar. He's got his shirt wrapped around it for fingerprints. And he bashes the living daylights out of Frank Green. He puts Frank Green into retirement. Puts him in hospital for 3 months. Savage fractures all over the skull and face. And that is the end of Frank Green as a force in Sydney. And the rise of Chow Hayes. I mean, Chow Hayes now has a significant reputation.
He worked for a while at the legendary Tomo's Two-Up School. How brazenly did this illegal gambling parlour operate, Jack?
Well, there are about 3 different locations that, you know, they'd pack up and move on and so forth. This is what was called in those days SWI. So up to 1,000 men on a Thursday night, payday, and they would bet on the toss of 2 pennies. This is, again, within cooey of Central Station and that side of Surrey Hills. And with that sort of activity, a lot of money going around, a lot of booze being consumed and so forth, there's often a little bit of violence. There'd be some brawls and some fist fights and so forth. So there was security there, and they have the sort of bouncers. But if ever things got out of hand, Chow Hayes would be called upon to come down with the guns. And just the sound of his name would calm most people down.
Chow Hayes had a racket going which was known as the Cabbage Leaf Racket. Can you just please explain what the Cabbage Leaf Racket was, please, Jack?
It's a beautiful old racket, this one. And now we're getting into World War II. So US servicemen are flooding into the country, particularly through the docks around Sydney, and they need cigarettes. So what Chow Hayes' gang was doing was buying tobacco, adulterating it with dried cabbage leaves and then repackaging it and selling it for cigarettes and just selling it to servicemen at the docks.
Oh, that's a low-down thing, Jack, isn't it?
It is. Look, I don't know. I don't know the health impacts of smoking dried cabbage. It's probably not going to give you great breath. But I've read various claims about how much they were making, and someone was saying up to £10,000 a week, which sounds a little bit too much, but certainly it's a very lucrative business. US servicemen fresh off the boat, be offered some tobacco, be offered a packet of cigarettes, not knowing at all that they were smoking cabbage.
So if he's raking in all this money from selling dodgy, adulterated cigarettes to US service people, what did he do with all the money he's making?
Well, the first thing is to say he didn't come up with this plan. He's just sitting over the top of it
right.
And saying, all right, if you guys are going to make all this money, I want some. That'll be your form of security. No one will come near you because they'll know that you're being protected. Everyone had to kick money up to Chow just so they could stay in business. Otherwise, there'd be terrible trouble from him. it's one of those things.
And nice little cabbage leaf operation you got there. It'd be a shame if anything happened to it.
I will protect you from me. That's essentially what he was saying. So this is how he makes his living all the time.
And what was he doing with his money?
I was just gambling it. I mean, he was a terrible, hopeless, degenerate gambler. And he would spend many days down at Randwick, or they used to have the ponies, which is the sort of horses that weren't quite ready for the thoroughbred racing, and they'd run them in these quiet tracks somewhere. So the ponies, the thoroughbreds, the greyhounds, whatever was moving, Chow would have a bet on it. I mean, basically he used to walk down to the bookie and the betting rings and say, give us 50 quid. And that, of course, they would. You know, they'd just give him some money. So he was always often betting with other people's money. But by the end of the night, he had nothing left. He was hopeless.
One of his partners in this cabbage leaf racket was a man named Eddie Wayman. Tell me how the partnership with Eddie Wayman and Chow came unstuck, please, Jack.
Well, Chow believed that Eddie Wayman, who's running the cabbage racket, had ripped him off, had not paid him enough, had not declared all of his earnings from all of this. So that was it. I mean, Chow has to, as an extortionist, he has to make an example of someone like that. Chow Hayes has to tell everybody that this is what happens if you dud Chow Hayes. He shot him in a hotel in Glebe. He shot him twice. He's very brazen about these things, Chow. You know, he would assault people, and in this case, shoot people in front of large crowds of people, knowing full well that no one was going to assist police with their inquiry, so to speak.
And did this actually succeed in killing Eddie Wayman, the shooting?
He shot him and wounded him. Wayman was out of hospital very quickly, within a week, and they had another meeting. And they both assured one another that, you know, it had all gotten out of hand and terribly sorry, and yes, look, we'll just forget about it and we'll move on. We'll get back to the cigarette racket. But as Chow Hayes says, Eddie Wayman said he was going to let it go, and I said I was going to let it go, but he wasn't going to let it go, and I wasn't going to let it go.
This is how he explained what happened.
I knew he was going to kill me. I'd shot him 6 days beforehand, and he said he was going to forget about it, but I knew he wasn't. I told him the same, that I was going to forget about it, but I had no intentions of forgetting about it, because I knew that as soon as he had the opportunity to kill me. So it was a paddock in town hall on New Year's Eve, 1945, and I was told that he was at home. I went down to his place at Mary Street, Surrey Hills, and walked to the back way, and he was laying in bed in the singlet. So I said, hey, I'll finish what I'd done earlier. I was shot him 5 times.
And that was it. Eddie Wayman was dead.
It's so matter of fact, isn't it? I mean, look, he was charged with the murder and he was acquitted, so he couldn't be recharged, and he knew that. And so many years later, when he's talking with Margaret Throsby, he's happy enough to confess to this. But what he did was shoot Eddie Wayman in the back 5 times. Wayman was still recovering from his injuries a week earlier and was asleep in his bed, face down. So when Chow says, this is for you, there was no contact with him. He just crept into his house and shot him 5 times in the back.
On ABC Radio, this is Conversations with Richard Feidler. Podcast, broadcast, and online. Subscribe to our free podcast service. Details on our website, abc.net.au/conversations.
Tell me the story, Jack, about the man at the newsstand who once happened to be a witness for Chow's handiwork one night.
I looked at this. I've never been able to find out exactly when it happened, but Hayes was asked about it many years later, and he didn't deny it. But those who know Sydney well would know that the top of Oxford Street, with Bourke Street to the left and Taylor Square over the road to the right, there was a newsstand. It's been there for many years. I think it's gone now, but only in the last 3 or 4 years. But it had been a newsstand for many, many years.
Yeah, it's where you could go to buy the papers first thing in the morning.
That's right, yeah. So it was a bit of a fixture in Sydney. And just a door down from there, above the shop, was a sly grog shop. And so this place would be open all night. It would be paying police protection, so they didn't bother them too much. And criminal fraternity and ne'er-do-wells generally would be up there having a drink to the wee hours. And Chow Hayes, well, he never drove a car, but a driver drove Chow Hayes and just pulled up outside this sly grog shop. And as a Sydney criminal, I don't know this fellow's name. I've never been able to find out the event, or when the event actually occurred. But he came down the stairs, and Chow Hayes just got out of the car and shot him dead in front of the newsstand and the fellow selling the newspapers, who's just shaking, just in shock at just what he's seen.
Chow Hayes just shot this guy dead right on Oxford Street, right on Taylor Square there.
It's 4 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
There's no one around except for this newspaper vendor. And Chow just gets in the car and the car drives off. And this fellow's just shaking like a leaf. And then he sees the car stop up Oxford Street, do a U-turn, and slowly come back towards him. Do another U-turn and pull up just outside the newsstand. And this fellow, according to the stories that I've heard, was almost collapsing with fear. And Hayes got out of the car again with both hands in his pocket. And he pulled his hand out and thrust a £20 note into the newspaper vendor's hand and said, "There you go, son, that's for your bad eyesight." And so it's a difficult story to verify. I'd heard it many, many times told. Difficult to verify because, of course, the newspaper stand fellow, once he'd taken the £20 for his bad eyesight, was never really going to put his hand up and, as I say, assist police with their inquiries. That's for your bad eyesight, son. So, yeah, we shouldn't be laughing about cold-blooded murders, but you just sort of tells you that Chow had given this a bit of thought. I could go back and blast him, but if I just put 20 quid in his hand, no doubt he'd be just as cooperative.
It wouldn't be true to say that Chow Hayes was kind of an amoral creature. He did operate under his own kind of moral code, even if many people would find that moral code repugnant. Here he is once again talking with Margaret Throsby about the kind of code of honour he operated under.
Did you have any conscience or remorse about anybody that you killed?
No.
Is that because you felt they were all bad people?
Yeah.
Would you have ever killed anybody you thought was a good person?
No.
Would you have killed a woman?
No. Respected women in our days. Respected women.
So there you go, Jack. He reckons that he was operating under a moral code. And would he ever kill or hurt civilians, non-gangster types?
No. Look, in Chow's world, there were two types of people. There were the criminals like himself, and then there were the people that he referred to as squareheads.
Squareheads.
Squareheads were law-abiding citizens. It was okay to steal from them. I mean, this is the sort of blurry lines of Chow Hayes' morality. It was okay to steal from them, but when it came to the exercise of violence, whether it be a bashing or a murder, the Hayes morality said this had only happened in-house. You could only kill other criminals. Other criminals were fair game. But the squareheads, they were left alone, other than being the victims of property crime.
What about women? He seemed to be quite emphatic about that. Was that true?
Yeah, that certainly was true. And we haven't talked about his wife. He married his childhood sweetheart called Gladys King. She was known as Topsy. And he doted after her. And he deliberately kept her out of his business. Now, she would never have known what he was up to at any given time. God, he wouldn't have been home very often. He's also in and out of jail all the time too. He's getting 3 months here and 6 months there. So he would have been a fairly, you know, sort of absentee husband to a large degree. But he deliberately kept his wife away from all of the stories. She was a squarehead too, as far as he is concerned.
It was only one occasion where she came even close to one of his criminal adventures.
Well, this is the murder of Bobby Lee. And we talked about before the Tomo's tour that Chow ran the protection racket when things got out of hand. He'd come down with the guns. But normally, for just your average sort of fisticuffs and what have you, Bobby Lee ran the bouncers there. And Bobby Lee was an ex-boxer. And he ran the security there. And on one occasion in 1951, a number of members of Chow's gang were at Tomo's two-up, and Bobby Lee and his bouncers set upon them and gave them a hiding. And when they reported to Chow, well, there was going to be a response. But Bobby Lee decided to get in early. Either he or one of his gang, they go around to Chow's house. They look in through the window, they see a male figure listening to the radio, they figure it's Chow, and the gun fires and kills the man sitting in the chair. But it's not Chow Hayes, it's his nephew, Danny Simmons.
So they've assassinated the wrong man?
Not just the wrong man, but again, a squarehead,
right.
A non-combatant. And look, I've seen photographs from the funeral, and the women are howling. And there you see Chow Hayes, and there's this fierce look on his face. And you know, if you were there, if you saw this photo, you know he's going to make terrible vengeance. Bobby Lee realises what's happened and that he's made a very, very big mistake. And he goes into hiding. And that lasts for about 8 weeks until a phone call comes through to Chow telling him that Bobby Lee was going to be, that night, was going to be at the Zelig Club. And the Zelig Club was a drag act club. And so Chow's sidekick, and a man almost as violent as Chow himself, was a bloke by the name of Joe Hollabone. So Chow rings Hollabone and says, get over here, we'll get up to the Zelig Club and we'll sort Bobby Lee out once and for all. Unfortunately, Joe Hollabone's wife thinks he's having an affair. He may well have been having an affair, I don't know, but she's very suspicious about this sudden, I'm going to go to the Zelig Club move. And so she says, I'm going to come along too. We'll have a night out and it'll be, you know, we'll sort out some of our marital problems.
Oh, my God.
So she's in the car. And the car pulls up at Chow's place, and Chow's wife, Topsy, she looks out the window and says, well, if she's going, I'm going too. And we'll have a night out on the tiles.
So it's Mr. and Mrs.
The four of us.
Mr. and Mrs. Hitman, front seat and back seat.
That's right. So these women, the wives, are being dragged along to a murder, and the men can't actually bring themselves to say, look, this is really not where you want to be tonight. What were they going to say? Look, you can't go there because I'm going to murder Bobby Lee tonight. And that makes Topsy an accessory.
Right. Yes.
And this becomes an issue later on. But he doesn't tell her anything, of course. So he's basically, okay, well, we'll sort it out. Sort it out as we go. And so the four of them sit in the corner. They can see Bobby Lee, and Chow's just snarling at him, and Bobby Lee's sitting there with half a dozen of his friends. The place is packed. There are about 80 people in this nightclub in Market Street. It's a downstairs sort of place, a bit sort of seedy and out of the way. And Chow says to Hollabone, you get the women out. And he just gets up from his chair and pulls his gun, marches over to see Bobby Lee, and Bobby Lee says to him, you're not going to shoot me in front of all these people, Chow. And Chow just says, this is for you. Bang, 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 bang. Shoots him 5 times, and the place erupts in a pandemonium. People are trying to get out to the stairs and so forth. Chow, with the gun in hand, just makes his way out of the club. Everyone's getting out of his way, and he takes off and goes into hiding, and Bobby Lee is dead in the Zelig Club.
Now, all these people have seen this happen. I mean, there's 80 people in the club. They've actually witnessed the shooting of this man.
Unless they are particularly unobservant, they have witnessed a particularly brutal murder. And of those 80 people, not one would come forward and cooperate with police.
Not one.
And that's not a reflection on them necessarily. That's a reflection on, oh my God, it's Chow Hayes. So am I going to be the person who gives evidence against Chow Hayes? People aren't going to do that. So of those 80 people, you had a blank police notebook and not one of them wanting to cooperate at all.
So what happened once police actually found Chow Hayes and got him out of hiding, Jack?
The arresting officer was Ray Kelly, who is a sort of very corrupt figure. And we've talked about him before.
And the killer himself too, Jack.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, this was a very, very corrupt police officer. He was the mentor of Roger Rogerson. So Kelly arrests Chow, but they've got no evidence. I mean, they can't even put him at the scene. So they actually got some fellows, they got one particular fellow down from Melbourne, dragged him up and said, "You're at the Zelly Club." And, you know, they got him to concoct evidence against Chow Hayes.
And this is how Chow Hayes described to Margaret Throsby how it all worked when Ray Kelly came up to him and told him how the trial was going to unfold.
He said to me, when he arrested me, he said, "I'll charge you the same as I charged all the others. You tell as many lies you can to beat it, Chow, and I'll tell as many lies I can to convict you."
That's how it works, Jack. You're going to tell as many lies to get off, and I'll tell as many lies as I can to convict you.
It's a wonderful battle to just imagine. I mean, these are two pathological liars, and just who's going to outlie the other. But early on, in the first two trials of Chow Hayes for the murder of Bobby Lee, it looked like Chow was going to succeed because Kelly had no witnesses, and they concocted one at least. But then Kelly went that extra step. Kelly told Chow, he said, "If you don't lie down on this trial, the third trial, so I'm going to charge your wife with being an accessory after the fact." And Chow finally relented, and he was convicted in 1954 and sentenced to hang.
That was what got him to lay down and admit to the charge.
Yeah.
Was bringing
his
wife into it.
That's right, yes. I mean, you could think of Chow Hayes as being this sort of unrestrained sociopath. But it doesn't really equate, because he's got this wife that he will protect and dotes after. He's got four children at home too. So he's actually being able to at least compartmentalise his violence and appalling behaviour to where he's almost a sort of normal father and husband.
So the court accepted his guilty plea and he was condemned to death, sentenced
That's
to
right.
hang. Clearly he didn't swing. What happened?
Well, the New South Wales government, the Labor government at the time, in 1956, so just 2 years after he was convicted, took the death penalty off the books, and Chow's sentence was commuted to life in prison. And in those days, in New South Wales, if you got life, that generally meant 20 years.
How much of that sentence did he end up serving?
And he did 13. So it could have been a lot worse for Chow, of course. He did tell Bill Leake, while Bill was painting his portrait, Bill asked him what his political views were, and Chow said he'd never voted in his life, but he always fondly regarded the Labor Party because they'd taken the death penalty off the books and spared his neck. And that tells you a fair bit about Chow. He mightn't have thought too deeply about politics, but the people who'd spared his life, he thought quite favourably about.
Right. Tip the hat to the Labor Party for that.
Yes, yes.
How did that stretch in prison go for him, those 13 years, Jack?
Well, Chow's been in and out of jail most of his life. But the previous sentences are relatively small. 3 months here, 6 months there, 12 months there. I've seen his criminal record. And the old saying, record as long as your arm. You and I could hold hands and his criminal record would still not be as long as both of our arms. It goes on for 6 pages. There are just convictions everywhere, most of them at magistrate's level. So he gets 3 months. He does 6 months. But this one's a big one. And he goes away 1954, he gets out 1967. And in that time, it's this really profound sort of social change going on in Australia. And it's something that Chow never really understood or respected in any way. So towards the end of his jail sentence, he's getting in a lot of fights in prison. He's getting a lot of fights with younger men. He's trying to stand over them. This is the only skill he's got. He's getting old now. He's into his 50s. He's not a terrifying person anymore. But the only skill he has is to demand money or goods from people and tell them they're going to be bashed if they don't pony up with it. Now, towards the end of his sentence, Chow's sharing cells with, you know, the kings of crime at the time, the counter-jumpers, the armed robbers. These are very violent, willing men. Chopper Reed told a story, perhaps apocryphal, that Chow Hayes and Russell Mad Dog Cox were both in the same prison, but albeit in different divisions, and that Chow Hayes had made it clear to Russell Cox that he needed to hand over all his tobacco to Hayes. And Russell Cox is an incredibly fit, strong, tough man. So what do I have to do this for this old bloke for? You know, I mean, why do I have to do that? You know, just tell him no, and if he wants to sort it out, I'll sort him out. This is where Chow starts getting some scars and a great big chunk bitten off his ear from all these fights he's getting into in jail.
So this is a new breed of criminal that was coming into the system and thriving outside and around the cross and coming into the jails. These are the new heroin traffickers too, Jack, aren't they? This is a whole other breed of criminal. Was not really operating on the same kind of dodgy moral code that Chow was operating under.
No, that's right. And Chow goes back to jail in 1971, I think. And there he's up against these people who are starting the embryonic drug trade in Australia. And they're pretty willing people. And they're not going to be stood over by, at this stage, a man in his late 60s, regardless of his reputation from 20 years ago.
A criminal from the jazz age, do you? Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. But Joey Hollabone, his sidekick, Hollabone makes that transition, but Chow can't. And that's probably because Chow couldn't take orders. I mean, that was, you know, Len McPherson couldn't sit Chow down and say, "So I want you to go and see A, B, and C, and I want you to tell them this." Chow would just go there and just get violent. He couldn't make that transition.
When he left jail in 1982, he was an old man. Was he probably washed up as a tough guy by then?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, well, he's 70. One by this stage. I mean, you can't be running around as a septuagenarian extortionist.
Well, you can just run away, can't you?
You know, it's almost sort of Python-esque sort of image there. So this is the problem with extortionists. You know, they run out of steam, and Chow has. No other life skills. Yeah. So his wife and two of his four children have died while he's been in jail for the Bobby Lee murder.
Oh, dear. Topsy died.
Yes. Oh. Yeah. And, you know, his release from jail occurred a year or so after her death. So, he wasn't allowed to attend the funeral and all these sorts of things. He's still an inveterate, horrible, hopeless punter. He's living in a public housing apartment in Lidcombe. And he goes down to the Lidcombe TAB. And basically, this is how he makes his money. He's going around to young punters and saying, "Give us $50." I mean, he's sort of getting away with that,
right.
And so forth. So he's sort of, you know, running out the clock this way. But Chow becomes a gangster celebrity in the latter part of his life. The Hickey biography is written. Hickey sits down with him. And Chow wants to write some glamorous story about himself, but Hickey is a very fine journalist and insists that he will write the story the way it should be written in an entirely factual way. In fact, he tells Hayes, "Look, if you lie to me once, this project's not going to happen." So, again, while they're writing the book, when Chow would come and see Hickey, according to Hickey, who I spoke to about this, he you know, Chow'd say, "You got $50, have you got $20? He's always still hitting people up for money. And that's pretty much tells you that's the only skill he's got. But the book was published to some acclaim, and it was reasonably successful. And Chow went on the publicity circuit, I mean, with Hickey. And Hickey said, you know, you'd go to an interview and you knew full well you weren't going to get asked a question. Everyone was just, you know, wanting to talk to Chow Hayes.
Eventually, though, Hickey fell out with Chow. What did they fall out over?
Look, I've had some experience with this, and I had similar experience with Chopper Reid and so forth. When criminals see a book come out or a movie come out that's based on their lives or has, you know, they've had some involvement with, they delude themselves into thinking that just the mere fact of a book has been published equals $1 million. I mean, this is the delusional aspect of it. I had a meeting with Chopper Reid before I did an interview with him, and I met him in this terribly scungy pub in Collingwood, I won't name, but it's still there, and he pulled me aside and said, the people that had done the movie Chopper, they owed him millions, according to Chopper Reid. They owed him millions, and he wasn't going to stop, and if he sees X, Y, or Z, he's going to kill him. And he had deluded himself to believe that because the movie had been made, that he was owed literally millions of dollars. And Chow Hayes was exactly the same. When this book came out, and he might have seen it on listed on the bestsellers and so forth, which in Australian terms is a fairly modest sale anyway, and just, you know, he just believed that he was owed literally hundreds of thousands of dollars from his biographer, Hickey, and it just wasn't true.
And when Hickey wasn't able to hand over those millions of dollars to him?
Well, let's not forget that Hickey's been handing him pretty much 50 a visit all the way. So Chow's well in front.
Right.
But Bill went to see Chow when he was dying of lung cancer in hospital. And when Bill walked in, he sat up and he's coughing blood up everywhere and he's in a terrible state. And you could tell he really didn't have very long to live. And the first thing he said to Bill was, have you seen that bastard Hickey? And he said, well, yeah, I worked with him. I saw him this morning. He goes, you tell him if I have to drag myself out of this bed and crawl all the way to the Sydney Morning Herald, I'll do it and I'll go in there and shoot him. And Bill went back to the office and saw Hickey, and Hickey said, did you see Chow? He said, yeah, saw him. He says, is he still dirty on me? He said, yeah, he could say that. He just tricked himself. He tricked himself into believing that he was owed all of this money.
The kind of man who could utter a death threat on his deathbed.
Yeah, look, he would have died, I'm going to say, within 48 hours. So it may not have been his last words, but close enough. His last words were, I'm going to shoot him.
What was his funeral like?
Well, this is a funny story. I mean, Chow believed that the measure of a man was how many people attended their funeral. And he had been to the funeral of Joey Hollobone, and he came around and said, 200! There were 200 people at Joey Hollobone's funeral, and so this was a good life, a life well lived. And so Chow must have thought, gee, I hope we get a big crowd at mine. But of course he didn't. His family was largely gone. He was a sort of forgotten person. He was buried in front of a smattering of people. It would have been a more or less a pauper's funeral. And a year later, his ashes were scattered over his wife's cemetery plot at Rookwood.
He said he felt he had no choice but to go into crime. Such was the state of life in the slums of Sydney in the post-World War I era that it was either that or starve. But, you know, a lot of people did not starve and did not need to go around killing people with guns, Jack, at that time.
Exactly right. I mean, that's just the easy way out there for Chow. Yes, he had a very, very difficult childhood, but he was certainly not on his own there. Australia, post-World War I, there weren't many fathers around anyway. Look, he was a fellow who just pursued one rule, and that is, I'm going to be more violent than the next man, and my reputation will precede me wherever I go, and that will give me a living.
Wonderful to speak with you, as always, Jack, and thank you so much.
Thank you, Rich. It's been a pleasure.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
I spoke to Jack Hoisted about Chow Hayes in 2017. And in 2013, Jack wrote a book called Unholy Trinity, which was about former Victorian police detective Dennis Ryan and the years Dennis spent trying to bring a pedophile priest in Mildura to justice. Dennis was blocked not just by the church, but by his own police force. And now after the Royal Commission, and after Dennis has finally been awarded some compensation, That book has been revised and reissued, and you can find my conversation with Dennis Ryan from 2013 on our website, abc.net.au/conversations. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.